We're wrapping up our summer series today. This, I trust, we've been repeating all summer long. We've been looking at belief, what it means to be Adventist, and what it means to be Adventist here at La Sierra University Church. So we thought a great ending point would be to talk about eschatology. Well, I guess that's a point of applause. I see some of you cringing, though. Those of you that didn't clap, I think I might know why. You might have just been teleported back to the sixth grade trip to the Science Museum, where Ranger Rick was telling you about the difference between rabbit droppings and deer droppings. You hear the word scat, and you're teleported back to that time in your childhood. But have no fear. Eschatology, not scatology, is what we're covering today. The study of future events. If you didn't get it, then turn to someone near you, I guess. Eschatology, not scatology. The study of future things that we can't with any type of surety really claim we know anything about for certain. The study of the age to come, the return of Christ. So where do I begin? Well, when I was 10 years old, I didn't know that we couldn't know much for certain about the end of times, so I knew for certain. I knew what I would be doing in the age to come, in the new heaven and the new earth after Christ had returned. I knew that I would be riding around in style around heaven. I'd be riding a T-Rex, and I'd be riding him off of a chocolate waterfall, taking laps. This is what I would be doing day in, day out, all day, every day. Laps on old Rex forever and ever. Amen. We all have our own picture in our minds about what the age to come will be like. We have our own beliefs about life after death. Is there a life beyond this one that is a better version of this one? And if so, in what ways is it better? How will we feel? What will it look like? What will we experience? Is it an age of selfish indulgence? Eating ice cream and riding dinosaurs around heaven? Will we spend our time singing holy, holy, holy with the heavenly chorus on the glassy sea? Is it an age spent gardening and creating what God intended back in Eden? Do we all have mansions, or do we even need houses? Will we have possessions that we need a house to keep them in? If it's always light outside, will we need a place to sleep? Or will we just take occasional naps in the heavenly grass? Do we dance? Are there conga lines that roll around heaven and go by the jeweled gates, led by the Ghanaian choir? What will the second advent look like? How will we get there? Will Jesus really be riding a white horse coming in the clouds? So many questions. And reading the scriptural accounts can leave us with even more questions than answers. We just heard a beautiful passage of scripture read by the Tamanaha family, Isaiah 65. Look, I'm creating a new heaven and a new earth. I'm doing a new thing. Past events won't even be remembered. Be glad and rejoice forever at what I'm creating, because I'm creating Jerusalem as a joy and her people as a source of gladness. They will build houses and live in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They won't build for others houses to live in, nor plant for others to eat. Like the days of a tree will be the days of my people. My chosen will make full use of their handiwork. I know that's the desire of many of us. If only I could make full use of my handiwork, I would be fulfilled. They won't labor in vain. Wolf and lamb will graze together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox, but the snake, its food will be dust. We'll build houses. Sorry to those of you that dread manual labor. You're gonna have a construction belt on and a hard hat, a hammer in hand. If you don't have a green thumb and don't care to develop one, you'd better start caring, because your food will be coming from the plants that you plant. Snakes will be eating dirt, and lions will be sharing hay bales with horses. This sounds weird to some of us, and not necessarily what we imagine when we think of the new earth, God's restored ideal. But to some of us, this might actually sound like a pretty good life. Good, honest work, living off the fruit of your labor. That's one vision, one snapshot of heaven. That's Isaiah's vision. And we fast forward several hundred years, Revelation 21, and we have a different snapshot, a different perspective. John sees a city being brought to earth with 12 beautiful gates and 12 pillars, each with the name of the 12 tribes. You could have guessed how many tribes of Israel on them. 12, 12, 12. There's numbers that keep reappearing in this chapter. He is told to measure it, and he finds that it is built in a square 1,500 miles long, 1,500 miles deep. Guess how many miles high? 1,500. It's a cube. It's a massive cube. Walls 200 feet thick, covered in jewels. The city itself is made of pure gold that seems to be transparent like glass. The gates made from one single pearl each, and we have to pause there. Where is this clam bed with clams that size? Somewhere in the universe, some far off corner. Anyhow, the gates are never shut because it's never night. There is no need for a sun or a moon because everything is seen by the light of God. There is a river flowing right through the middle of the city, and on each side grows the tree of life, one enormous fruit tree with roots on both sides of the banks. This is a very fantastical, and yes, that is a word, I looked it up, image of the city. But these two images seem almost a bit at odds with each other, don't they? One says, we'll do work, we'll live a simple life, we'll plant vineyards, we'll eat from it, we'll enjoy long lives together, we won't have to worry about the lives of our children being cut short. 100 years, that's, you'll be just entering puberty by then. Things will be different. Things will be good. There will be peace where there was once animosity. The lion and the lamb have worked it out somehow. The other passage, Revelation, is about a brand new thing God is bringing to earth, a pre-made, jeweled city. It seems a bit more static. No homes to build, streets where gold is asphalt, glorious light always emanating from God. No need for peace to be made amongst enemies. We've got thick walls to deal with them. These are the two images of heaven. There are more images. There are really as many images as there are people here. We each have this different picture that's been painted in our minds. And let's watch this pop culture image or vision of the age to come.
I just ring this little bell. Ta-da! This is Albert, my manservant. Now we have more time for me and my filly. Albert, darling, I'm sending this back. You were a little stingy on the filly.
Only Philadelphia cream cheese is a little taste of heaven.
Ah. Oh, you can be replaced, you know.
Rough. Not the job you want, to be a manservant in heaven. If I hadn't preempted you with what we were going to see, we all would have known where the setting was supposed to be taking place, right? You would have seen it, and from the first still shot, you would have known, ah, this is supposed to be heaven. We all knew, but why? What were the clues? Clouds. Okay, heaven is full of clouds? Where does that come from? We all know it, but why? How? Where did we get that? What else? We get wings? Awesome. I don't remember that from Sabbath school class. But yeah, I guess it's that's in our mind somehow. The manservant was a new addition, but you know, we can be flexible. We each have these different images, and often there's these cultural images that might not have anything to do with anything really, but somehow they've entered our cultural consciousness. White clouds, wings, self-indulgence, these are things that currently make up the myth in our culture. Heaven is a fluffy, static place. You get a harp, you get a corner on the clouds, and responsibility doesn't exist unless, of course, you're the unlucky manservant. You know, in fact, A fun fact, I think I've actually heard Pastor Sam break this down for us before today. This isn't something new, but the Bible never actually mentions mansions in heaven. Jesus begins by saying, in my house are many, a lot of, whoa, okay. That, you'll come back to that bookmark there. You'll be ready for that in a few minutes. We all know how to finish that line. We all know that we're supposed to say mansions because we had that growing up. At least I did. In my house, in my Father's house, are many mansions. But actually, a more faithful translation might be rooms, dwellings, habitations. But I want my mansion. I want it. I grew up reciting in Sabbath school this verse, in my Father's house are many mansions. I want my mansion. I grew up dreaming of my mansion. I always kind of imagined really a treehouse though, treehouse type of mansion where the roots made this like big one room kind of area. It was really sweet. But what if it's different? What if it's different than we imagine? Are we okay if the age to come, the big move of God is different than we imagine? Are we okay if it's different? The modern day parable goes like this. One night around a campfire, Jesus and his disciples were talking. And he began to compare God's intentions with the people of Israel and their future to that of a groom courting a bride. God and I love you so much that he's actually got a lot of dwellings. I'm going to go prepare one of them for you like a groom does for a bride. And hearing that, the disciples all eagerly started discussing what they imagined their mansions would look like, what special features theirs would include. Well, mine's going to have an overhead shower. Mine's going to have this and that. Who would have the sweeter pool and water slide? Whose golden driveway would be longer? And they bantered back and forth like this until they all fell asleep, leaving only Jesus and an old unknown and poor disciple staring in silence, deep in thought, into the fire. At long last, the old disciple worked up the courage to ask the question that was on his heart. He said,
you know, Rabbi, I've been thinking. Well, you know, you have all these big and influential people following you, preachers and teachers, thinkers, politicians, philosophizers. I was wondering if there might be any room for me. They all talk about their mansions and everything, but, well, I've never even seen a mansion, let alone been in one. I don't think I need all of that, and, well, I was just wondering, do you think there's room enough for an old man like me?
Well, you know, if you go out past those mansions that the others talk about, you go down to the end of one gold-paved street, and there's a hill, a little dirt path going up. About halfway up that hill, there's, well, it used to be a stable. It's not much to look at. But on a clear night, with the stars gleaming overhead and a cool breeze in the air, it's not bad. Maybe you could stay there with me.
What if it's different than we imagine? You see, asking questions about literalness might be the wrong questions. I think this is a needed insight anytime we read anything in the Bible. When reading about creation, questions of literalness aren't necessarily the most essential questions. When reading about the story of Jonah, or Job, when reading the Psalms, questions of literalness aren't necessarily the best questions. If you hold some of these writings to a standard of literalness, you might be requiring something of them that the authors never intended. A better question might be, why did these stories become vital to the communities they were told in? Why did they stand the test of time? Why was this story formative for the people that it was written to and the time that it was written in? Why did they keep retelling it? The creation story's power isn't necessarily in its literalness, but rather in the fact that it introduces a brand new concept. You see, other cultures at the time, Babylon, for instance, talked about warring gods, Marduk, Tiamat. Marduk defeats Tiamat and with her broken body creates everything that is. For your average Babylonian, their idea of what was at the core of reality was death, destruction, war, animosity. That's what they were walking around thinking was the engine of creation. But here comes the Israelites, this people of God with a different story. Actually, there is a different God. This God's name is, they didn't even say the name. This God's name is the name. And this God created not out of destruction and anger. This God created out of joy. This God created out of enjoyment of what is good. There's a much different principle at work here. Maybe questions of literalness are the wrong questions in some cases. When you ask why Isaiah's vision was important to the people of Israel rather than is that really what heaven is going to be like? Then maybe we'll start to realize that he was writing to a people that were in exile, far from home. They've been ripped from the places that were familiar to them. And in this new and strange land, they were being forced to build houses for others. They didn't get to enjoy the fruit of their labor. They were forced to work in the fields, but they didn't get to see the fruit that they helped grow arrive on their own tables. There was an imbalance in the community that they were a part of. Do you ever feel like as much as you work, you can't get ahead? Like the work that you do benefits your employer maybe, but you don't get to enjoy that benefit. Isaiah was writing to a tired people who longed for a peaceful existence where they felt like their work mattered. Fast forward several hundred years, and the people of Israel still hadn't caught a break. They'd been kicked back and forth, back and forth. The temple, the main source of pride and identity, so central to who they were, had been destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed again, and left in ruins. They didn't hold any notable place in the world, and here comes John writing to them, an exile in double exile from an island, Patmos. He tells them about a fortified city with walls big enough to withstand any siege, about food growing right inside the city, about a clean, drinkable river flowing right through the middle. They've got gates made from Gimondo pearls that came from huge clams somewhere. These gates will never be shut. There's no enemies that we need to shut out anymore. There will be no night for enemies to sneak in and steal. No armies marching on them. For a people denied the fruit of their labor for so long, a safe city with jewels and gold where they would no longer need a temple that could be ripped away from them again because God was going to live right amongst them. This was the most amazing vision of an age to come imaginable. Maybe literalness isn't what's important in the Revelation story, the Revelation vision, but instead the underlying principle that at the center of God's heart, there is always this desire to give rest to the tired, to give stability to the war-torn, to heal the broken, to humble the greedy, to resurrect the complacent, to ignite passion in dead hearts, to satisfy our soul's deepest needs, and along with it, always an invitation to join God's initiative and be a part of creating this kingdom reality that God is casting the vision for. Another modern-day parable tells us that Christ returns anonymously one dull Monday. He's come back to earth, to some large city, to go about his Father's business. There's much for him to do, the same sick, the same poor, the same oppressed as the last time he had come to visit. For a long time, no one took notice of this desert wanderer with the weather-beaten face that lived among the broken. The great city labored on, ignorant of the one who lived in its bowels. But eventually, Christ decided to reveal his identity to some that had remained faithful and were expectantly awaiting the Messiah. There was a little church in one of the slums where he found them on a Wednesday night. Church wasn't full, but there was a small group in a corner of the room. Christ entered the room and could hear them praying, could hear them weeping, and they felt that someone else had entered the room. So one by one, they stopped praying and they looked up. And before too long, these people who had spent so many years praying anxiously, passionately, weeping for the return of the Messiah, recognized the one who they longed to see so much. The leader of the group rose and took a step forward to welcome Jesus. She said, "Lord, now that you're here, now that you're finally amongst us, we have but one question for you. Tell us, Christ, when will you return?" He didn't answer with words. He just smiled and joined them in with their tears and prayers. When will the Christ return? Christ is always looking for a body, a capital B body to show up in. When will Christ return? Now. The answer is always now. Right after the resurrection, shortly before the ascension, the disciples asked Jesus, "When are you going to bring your kingdom?" And he responds to them, "That's not for you to know. But here's what is. You are my witnesses. You're my ambassadors. You go be me. That's what's for you to know." And with that, he disappears, and they're left mouths open, staring into the sky. And it takes some heavenly messengers to come elbow them and be like, "What are you guys, why are you staring up in heaven? He told you, he handed the ball to you and said, run with it." They're standing there, mouths open. The heavenly messengers say, "Go, he told you to love, to do justice. He said, go build my kingdom now. When will the Christ return? Always now." But what if we could know? What if we had a date for this return of the Messiah? What if we could put it on our calendar, a Tuesday 6 months from now? What if we knew that Jesus would return at a specific date? Would you live differently? Maybe we would. Maybe we would spend more time with our families if we knew that our time on earth was limited. Maybe we would work less and take that trip we've always wanted to take. Maybe we would love more freely, not holding anything back. Maybe we would stand up more recklessly for what we know is right. Maybe we would be telling everyone that we meet that they were God's beloved. Maybe we would be living with less fear, refusing to let wrongs go unrighted. Maybe we would be forgiving our enemies, making peace with estranged friends and family members. Maybe that's how we would live differently if we knew that Christ was to come back on a Tuesday 6 months from now. But why not live that way now? When will the Christ return? Now. always now. Christ is always looking for a person, a group, a family, a body, a community to partner with. When will the Christ return? Now, always now, in us and through us. And what will the Christ's return look like? It'll look like us at our best, letting God be God and us be the followers, us open to God's heart for the poor, the broken, the hurting, the greedy, the complacent, the dead at heart. It will look like us living the way that Jesus lived, running with the ball. I don't like sports analogies much, but I kind of envision this picture. This one I do like. Jesus handed us a ball and said, go, and we've spent a couple thousand years talking about the ball, talking about the stitching, talking about the beautiful leather it's made out of, talking about how far he used to throw it, talking about the way that he would make these plays that threw everybody off. We've been doing everything but running with the ball. Jesus said, run with the ball. I gave you this way to live. When will the Christ return? Now. It'll look like us living his love, enacting his justice, embodying his mercy. It will be different than we imagine, and it'll be much more beautiful than we imagine when this body lets Christ do what Christ desires most deeply to do, and that's work in us and through us. When will he return? Now.